Chapter 8, H.R. 2797. Walking south from Union Station, I came to the north entrance of Capitol Hill. Police at security checkpoint use mirrors on the end of long silver handles to snoop under vehicles. Others in gray jumpsuits handle German shepherds that sniffed each car before the police allowed it entrance. On each side of the checkpoint, cement flower pots the size of hot tubs served as blockades against truck bombers. I walk between the flowered barriers, along with dozens of other people who poured out onto the courtyard, which stretched for the length of about 3 football fields across the front of the Capitol, which glistened in the May sun like an ancient Mediterranean fantasy. On the south side of the Capitol, off a side street, I entered the Raybard Building. Having passed through an airport-like metal detector, I walked along the white marble floors, took an elevator to the second level, and came to room 2237, where the Subcommittee on the Civil and Constitutional Rights of the House Judiciary Committee was about to begin. Inside, I met other Adventist religious liberty representatives who were there to lobby in favor of the bill being debated that May morning before the Subcommittee, H.R. 2797, otherwise known as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The what Restoration Act? Most people weren't aware that religious freedom needed to be restored. Nevertheless, the name was appropriate, and the story behind H.R. 2797 reveals not only how fragile our freedoms are, but how quickly the great controversy scenario about America repudiating its principles of religious freedom could happen. As with most free exercise issues today, the drama began with a religious minority, those who have unconventional religious practices but whose numbers are not enough to wield the electoral clout needed to protect those practices, like Adventists. The case centered on Alfred Smith, 70, a Klamath Indian and member of the North American Church. In the 1970, this former alcoholic started working as a drug rehabilitation counselor for the Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Prevention, ADAPT, in Oregon. When hired, he signed the standard contract stipulating that he would not use alcohol or illegal drugs. About the same time, Smith began delving into Native American customs, such as the Sioux Sun Dance, sweat lodges, and other ceremonies that were part of his spiritual quest, which included eating peyote. 24 states had exempted Native Americans who used peyote in religious ceremony from drug laws. Though Oregon at the time signed Smith the contract, did not exempt ritual peyote use, it does now, Smith thought that his contract did. It didn't, and ADAPT fired him. When he and another Native American, Galen Black, fired for the same reason, applied for unemployment benefits, the Oregon Employment Division denied their claims on the grounds that the two men lost their jobs for, quote, misconduct connected with work. Smith and Black appealed the decision, arguing that because their use of peyote was religiously motivated, the state cannot constitutionally deny their claim. An Oregon appeals court reversed the employment decision, and 4 years after Smith and Black lost their jobs, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled that the free exercise clause of the First Amendment protected their ceremony use of peyote. State officials appealed the ruling to the U.S. Supreme Court, which, after sending the case back to the state one more time, finally agreed to hear Employment Division versus Smith. When the 6-3 vote against Smith was announced in 1990, groups on all end of the political and religious spectrum, from the conservative Christian Rutherford Institute to the ACLU, the American Muslim Council to the National Council of Jewish Women, the Homeschool Defense League, to the Association of People for the American Way, all denounced the ruling. All this over a Supreme Court decision that refused unemployment benefits to a Native American fired for using peyote? Not quite. The real issue was not the decision, which was arguably bad, but the majority opinion written by Justice Antonin Scalia, which undeniably was. Scalia took the protection of religious freedom away from the courts and placed it in the hands of voters and legislators. Not exactly the safest place, especially for minority faiths. We now face, said Representative Steve Solars, the grim prospect of popular referenda to determine which religious practices will be protected and which will not. Religion will be subject to the standard of interest group politics that affect our many decisions. It will be the stuff of postcard campaigns, 30-second spots, scientific polling, and legislative horse trading. With Smith, America has digressed a long way from the time when the Supreme Court recognized that the purpose of the Bill of Rights was to, quote, withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitude of political controversy, to place them beyond the reach of the majorities and officials. Before Smith, the court said that certain rights, including freedom of worship, quote, may not be submitted to a vote, close quote, nor do they depend on, quote, the outcome of elections. Now, as Justice Scalia admitted in Smith, quote, it may be fairly said that leaving accommodation of certain religious practices to the political process will place at a relative disadvantage those religious practices that are not widely engaged in. What did Smith do? The big question concerning the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment is, to what extent does the Bill of Rights protect the free exercise of religion? The Free Exercise Clause, said the court years ago, embraces two concepts, freedom to believe and freedom to act. The first is absolute, but in the nature of things, the second cannot be. Why not? Because not everything done under the rubric of religion should be protected by the First Amendment. Suppose a cult arose that followed the ancient Canaanite practice of child sacrifice, or the Hindu one of sati, burning wives on funeral pyres. No court in the land would allow it to engage in those actions, no matter how firmly rooted or sincerely held the religious tradition was. Though polygamy, for instance, was an integral part of Mormonism, the courts would not allow the practice because, quote, the state had a perfect right to prohibit polygamy and all other open offenses against the enlightened sentiment of mankind, notwithstanding the pretense of religious conviction by which they are advocated or practiced. Yet, should all religious practices against, quote, the enlightened sentiment of mankind be prescribed? And is not the whole purpose of the Free Exercise Clause to protect practices deemed offensive by the majority? Should the court differ between suti and ritual use of peyote? When and how should the courts draw the line? By the 1940s, the Supreme Court deemed freedom of religion a fundamental right, preferred and precious, one that required extensive protection more than, for example, freedom of contract or economic freedom. The court began veering toward the strict scrutiny test of any government burden of a fundamental right, such as religious practice. The government had to face strict scrutiny by the courts if it denied an exemption to someone whose religious beliefs conflicted with a law. An Adventist Sabbath case in 1963 helped crystallize the strict scrutiny standard. In a situation much like Smith, Seventh-day Adventist Adele Sherbert lost her job because she refused to work on Sabbath when her South Carolina plant changed from a 5 to 6 day work week. Because her refusal was deemed misconduct, she was denied unemployment benefits, though South Carolina allowed benefits to those fired for refusing Sunday work. The case made it to the United States Supreme Court, which voted in her favor. In the majority opinion, written by Justice William Brennan, the court ruled that a person may not be forced to choose between allegiance to sincerely held religious beliefs and the receipt of generally available government benefits, such as unemployment compensation. He also enunciated the concept of compelling state interest, which meant that the state had to show why a certain religious practice for the good of the community should be forgiven. The idea was applied even before Sherbert v. Verner, such as in the Mormon polygamy cases, which merely helped codify it as a legal principle in free exercise cases. The genius of the compelling state interest test, and what made it such good, though not perfect, protector of religious freedom, was that the burden of proof rested on the government to demonstrate why a fundamental right such as free exercise of religion should not be allowed. The Constitution, said legal scholar Douglas Laycock, does not say that government may prohibit free exercise for compelling reason. Rather, the Constitution says absolutely that there shall be no law prohibiting free exercise. The implied exception is based on necessity, and its rationale runs no further than cases of clear necessity. Ideally, unless a state could pass the strict scrutiny of its motives to burden religious practice, the courts would vote in favor of those seeking exemption from the laws. The process wasn't perfect. How, for instance, did the court define what was compelling or of a paramount interest? And religious minorities didn't win under it, didn't always win under it either, especially in recent years. The court found reasons to infringe upon certain fundamental religious practices, but the test was designed to shield the fundamental right of religious freedom from government interference. Then came Smith, and overnight that protection vanished. Justice Scalia, joined by Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice White, Stevens, and Kennedy, O'Connor voted with the majority but refused to sign the opinion, held that the strict scrutiny test is not the appropriate standard of review for most free exercise cases. The government no longer should be burdened to prove any compelling state interest in order to justify a law that infringes upon a religious practice. Instead, if the law is not intended to interfere with a specific faith, but was a general law applying to everyone equally, then there was no constitutional right to exemption. It would be unconstitutional, for example, to make a Sunday law that specifically applied to Seventh-day Adventists, but not one that applied to everyone in general, including Adventists. If you wanted to change the law or be exempt from it, you must go to your state legislature. If your legislature doesn't oblige, then, according to the court, tough luck. Scalia wrote, with four other justices agreeing, that, quote, the record of more than a century of our free exercise jurisprudence, close quote, has made it clear that the Constitution, quote, does not relieve an individual of the obligation to comply with a valid and neutral law of general applicability, even though the law might incidentally burden a religious practice. For Scalia to apply the compelling state interest test, for Scalia to apply the compelling state interest test, quote, across the board to all actions thought to be constitutionally commanded would open the prospect of constitutionally required religious exemptions of almost every conceivable kind, ranging from compulsory military service to the payment of taxes, animal cruelty laws. To do so, he asserted, would court anarchy. Yet the record of more than a century of free exercise jurisprudence shows that the Constitution does make an attempt to relieve individuals of the obligation to comply with any law that burdens the free exercise protection. That's the whole purpose of the free exercise protection. The phrase that Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion doesn't have to mean only laws that specifically target religion, which even Scalia said were unconstitutional, but even laws of general applicability that would incidentally prohibit it. No wonder Justice Blackmun, in his dissent, charged that the majority decision mischaracterizes the court's precedent and effectuates a wholesale overturning of settled law concerning the religion clauses of our Constitution. Also, Scalia's argument that applying the compelling interest test across the board would court anarchy denies reality. Even after decades of applying the test, where is the anarchy? And his warning that it would require exemption from payment of taxes ignores a previous case in which the court, citing a compelling state interest, voted against those who, for a religious reason, didn't want to pay taxes. If Smith remains a prevailing free exercise jurisprudence, it's not difficult to see how it could affect Adventists. What could be a more valid and neutral law of general applicability than a Sunday law? Though the Sunday legislation depicted in Great Controversy is religious, as all Sunday laws really are, it could be initiated under the veer of economics, morality, or family values. Indeed, in a series of cases in the early 1960s, the Supreme Court ruled that those Sunday laws originally had a religious purpose, they were now secular and therefore constitutional. However Sunday legislation might first come, under Smith, Adventists would have no protection against it. Of course, the Great Controversy scenario can happen only under a reinterpretation of the Constitution far more radical than even Smith. For the United States government to allow persecution of Sabbath keepers on the pretense that their actions, quote, have provoked the displeasure of heaven, close quote, and then only by their punishment will this nation, quote, be restored to divine favor and temporal prosperity, the First Amendment would have to be weakened into meaninglessness. That hasn't happened yet. Nevertheless, Ellen White did write that, quote, our country shall repudiate every principle of its Constitution, and Smith is no doubt a step in that direction. Because Smith was such a bad decision, Representative Stephen Solars introduced into the House in June 1991 a bill to protect the free exercise of religion, H.R. 2797, otherwise known as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The gist of H.R. 2797 is to, quote, restore the compelling interest test as set forth by Sherbert v. Verner. In other words, if enacted into law, the bill would force the Supreme Court to restore the compelling interest test to free exercise cases. Unfortunately, H.R. 2797 faced many obstacles. Solars' election defeat in September 1992 didn't help matters either. 2 days of House committee hearings, the 2 days of House committee hearings in May 1992 were attempts to get it back on track. Representing two organizations normally at each other's throats, Andrew Dugan of the National Association of Evangelicals and Nadine Strossen of the American Civil Liberties Union were among those who testified in favor of its passage. Though dealing with free exercise, Smith actually symbolizes a much larger issue. What kind of government do we have? Is our country a majoritarian democracy in which the majority rules and decisions about rights and freedoms are left to the voters? Or are we a constitutional republic in which the government finds its power not only by popular vote, but also, as Harvard scholar Stephen Machado wrote, by, quote, its conformity with certain principles of justice and inalienable rights, which were held to be natural or of a higher moral standing than the will of the majority. Smith, which places a fundamental right like the free exercise of religion at the discretion of the masses, indicates that the Supreme Court is moving towards the former. In Great Controversy, Ellen Wright wrote that, quote, even in free America, rulers and legislatures, in order to secure public favor, will yield to the popular demand for a law enforcing Sunday observance. Liberty of conscience, which has cost so great a sacrifice, will no longer be respected. These words imply a majoritarian democracy. Our religious right, which should certainly have a higher moral standing than the will of the majority, will be subject to that majority anyway. This danger is not far-fetched. The highly publicized battle over Robert Bork's nomination to the Supreme Court dealt with this basic issue. The clash over my nomination, Bork wrote, was simply one battle in the long-running war for control of our legal culture. Bork represents the majoritarians, those who would like to see more power placed in the hand of the voters as opposed to the courts. For Bork, unless a right is specifically expressed in the Constitution and interpreted according to the original intent of the framers, that right does not exist and the court should not invent it. Where the Constitution is mute, he wrote, we should vote about these matters rather than litigate them. That view might sound sensible, but if implemented, would radically restrict our freedoms. However much Americans might revere the Constitution, it is, after all, over 200 years old. America is a radically more complex nation now than when the Constitution was framed by the few dozen men who arrived in Philadelphia on horseback and carriages. To interpret a 200-year-old document the way the Founding Fathers did in a nation of less than 4 million people, and to suppose that this interpretation will meet all the needs, challenges, and problems of a nation 200 years later and with 60 times the population is expecting too much. The Constitution cannot simply be applied the way the Founding Fathers would have today, can't be applied today the way the Founding Fathers would have, because they weren't dealing with our problems. The Constitution, wrote political satirist P.J. O'Rourke, is an equally forthright piece of work and quite succinct, 21 pages in the American Civics Easy Reader Large Type version, giving the complete operation and instruction for a nation of 250 million people. The manual for a Toyota Camry, which seats only five, is four times as long. The problem of applying a written document in the 1780s to people living in the 1900s can be seen in one example. Connecticut had an antiquated statute banning birth control. Law professors at Yale challenged it, and in Griswold v. Connecticut, the Supreme Court struck down the law as an unconstitutional invasion of the right of privacy, wrote Justice Douglas for the majority. Would we allow the police to search the sacred precincts of marital bedroom for telltale signs of the use of contraceptives? However logical Douglas's reasoning, one minor problem exists. Nothing in the Constitution deals with the right of privacy, much less the use of contraceptives. Bork argued, therefore, that there is no constitutional right to either, and that the law, which he himself thought was bad, should have been invalidated, but by the state legislature, not by the courts. There being nothing in the Constitution about maximum hour laws, minimum wage laws, contraception or abortion, Bork wrote, the court should have simply said that and left the legislative decision where it was. However, Bork's reasoning is the best argument against his own conclusion. Because the Constitution is not specific, we need a more expansive reading to cover today's specifics. The rights, freedoms, and laws in our modern society need to go beyond the literal meaning of a document that could possibly address contemporary issues. What, for example, did Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, the other framers know about airline deregulation, school busing, and wiretapping? Also, what other rights not mentioned in the document are constitutionally protected? Do married couples have a constitutional right to make love? What about unmarried couples? What about unmarried couples of the same gender? Because these actions aren't specifically mentioned in the Constitution, does that mean they do not exist except by popular vote? What makes the Smith decision so frightening is that it took a right mentioned in the document, free exercise, and placed it at the discretion of the legislative branch. If the court can do that with rights mentioned in the Bill of Rights, what can it do with those that aren't even there? Of course, other variables dealing with the 9th, 10th, 14th Amendments, incorporation, judicial deference, states' rights, original intent, substantive due process, and at least a dozen others all figure in the debate over how the Constitution should be interpreted. What's clear, however, is that Smith indicates a trend toward the narrowing the jurisdiction of the courts and placing more power in the hands of state and local government. That trend becomes even more significant because state and local government is where the new right has been seeking power. They are its target for the 90s. Though the Supreme Court in the 1992 abortion case didn't overturn Roe v. Wade, it allowed states to apply more restrictions on it, which will give the new right even more incentive to get power at state levels in order to limit abortion as much as possible. And it's almost certain that once they gain power, they won't stop with abortion. What's so important about Smith is that it reveals just how fragile our rights are. We like to think that the Constitution clearly and in detail enunciates our religious freedoms. Not quite. The basis of those guarantees in a nation of 250 million people and hundreds of faiths is found in only 16 words. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Two very broad strokes. No respected church scholar of today, wrote Derek Davis, is so bold as to declare with unqualified conviction the exact meaning of the religion clauses at the time of their passage. Little agreement exists over exactly what those 16 words mean, or the correct way to interpret them, to who they apply, or how to even apply them. The protections they have offered have been given flesh and blood only by their interpretations in the courts. But, as Smith has proven, the courts can pick them clean, can pick the bones clean. What Wee versus Wiseman, the 1992 legislated prayer and school case, showed too was that this nation was just one vote away, one vote from doing to the first ten of those words what Smith did to the last six, which is all but destroy them. Of course, now that Bill Clinton is president, he will certainly put justices on the court more likely to protect our freedoms. The ones likely to retire, however, are those who are already sensitive to religious freedom. So even under Clinton, the makeup of the court will be precariously dangerous for church-state separation. After referring to the First Amendment protections in the U.S. Constitution, Ellen White in The Great Controversy wrote, "Only in flagrant violation of these safeguards to the nation's liberty can any religious observance be enforced by civil authority." With Smith, we've just witnessed a flagrant violation of these safeguards of the nation's liberty. More will come.